Welcome to our 8th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson on the journalism faculty here, and we have distinguished guests with us this evening. Sandra Dykstra from the Dykstra Literary Agency here in Del Mar, and Amy Tan, wonderful writer, Joy Luck Club, 100 Secret Senses, Kitchen God's Wife, Bonesetter's Daughter, one of my favorite writers. And we have a rare treat that Amy will be reading from an upcoming book. Let me tell you the title. It is The Opposite of Fate by Putnam. It will be coming out this fall. The audio edition for it will be done by Brilliant, coming out this fall. And Amy, I just want to tell you what a thrill it is to have you here. Sandy, you and I have known each other for a while. It's always fun to be with you again. And Amy, if you can tell us a little about where this book is coming from, this one that will be coming out this fall, and what you'd like to read for us tonight.
I'm reading, as you said, from The Opposite of Fate, and I call it a book of musings because they are not really formal essays or pieces that started off on a particular topic, but I realized over the years of writing that I have been writing about this notion of the opposite of fate, that I had been born with a sense of fate in my family, as well as a sense of faith. And I had been looking for a great deal of my life for different alternatives because of certain circumstances that happened. So I thought what I'd do tonight is read to you the portion of from that book that actually deals a lot with a moment in my life when things came to a pivotal point. And where I will begin is I'm 15 years old in this, 14 years old actually, and it is 1967, and my father and my brother have been quite ill. Throughout my father's life, he was devoted to his beliefs in God, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. He practiced what he preached. He tithed 10%. He didn't smoke or drink or say, gee, gosh, or golly. He prayed when he became impatient or lost his temper. He practiced charity to others. He gave away my best dolls to my poor cousins in Taiwan. By the way, those cousins turned out to become multimillionaires, and they used to give me leftovers from their factory later on. He put his life in God's hands. He made us believe that if you have absolute faith, God would take care of the rest. Miracles would happen. About 10 years ago, I found some of my father's diaries. In one of his last diary entries, written at the end of May 1967, he stated that he still firmly believed that God would grant him a miracle and save his 16-year-old son from dying of a brain tumor. This was less than 2 months before my brother Peter died. And shortly after that entry, my father stopped writing in his diaries. But this was due to loss of ability rather than loss of faith. By then, my father couldn't hold a pen well enough to comment on the strange coincidence that he, too, had also been stricken with a brain tumor. For a month, my brother and father were in the same hospital, lying in different rooms, unaware of the condition of the other. I was 14, unable to talk to anyone about death, nor the impending deaths of my father and brother, nor the ones that awaited us, according to my mother, who believed we had been set upon by a curse. After my brother died, and as my father grew more feeble, my mother openly called upon the ghosts of her past. She prayed to a painting of her mother. She hired a geomancer to inspect the spiritual architecture, the feng shui of our suburban tract house. What forces were aligned against us? She sought faith healers who taught my mother to speak in tongues, a gibberish that convinced me she was insane. She blamed herself for not moving from this house, the one we had lived in the longest, 2 years. In that neighborhood, she now realized 9 bad things had already happened. The man down the street had a heart attack. This one lost his job. That one was getting divorced. Every day, she would count these disasters out on her fingers, asking herself uselessly why she had not seen them clearly before so we could escape our fate. When my father died, more phantoms sprang from my mother's past. Ideas about karmic retribution, reincarnation, and the presence of ghosts is signaled by our barking dog or misplaced object or door slamming when a certain name was mentioned. My mother was sure that what was uncertain in the real world could be accounted for in the supernatural one. There, the possibilities of what happened and why were boundless. And because my mother still believed I was sensitive to the other world, she often asked me to use a Ouija board to communicate with the ghosts of my father, my brother, and sometimes my mother's mother, a woman I had never met because she had died in 1925 when my mother was a girl of 9. There I sat before the dreaded Ouija board, my tearful mother opposite me. She was always hoping for one last goodbye, one more message of love. Pragmatic woman that my mother was, she would also ask the ghosts of the Ouija board for their expert opinions on the stock market. IBM or U.S. Steel, she would say. And I, the supposed purveyor of these spiritual answers, had to push the planchette to whatever came to mind just to get the ordeal over with. Upon reflection now, my spurious advice is probably no worse than that of a stockbroker's. My mother did amazingly well in growing her modest portfolio. My mother turned to the ghosts for childbearing advice as well, child-rearing advice as well. Amy treat me so bad, she once said. What I should do? Send her to Taiwan, school for bad girls? You know, and I took the planchette and deftly scooted to the correct answer. No. Another time, my mother wanted to know if she should open a Chinese restaurant. I immediately pictured myself washing thousands of greasy stained bowls. Bad idea, came the answer from the Ouija board, quashing any hopes my mother might have had there. In my memory, which I admit can be subjectively poor and riddled with a wild imagination, I recall that our sessions with the Ouija board were often accompanied by eerie signs that ghosts were indeed in the room. The room would become suddenly not just cold, but windy. A flower would suddenly snap from its stem as if in answer to an important question. A sound in the distance could be heard, first by my mother and then by me, and it seemed it was the voice of a crying woman. And once, as a high school friend of mine recently attested, the Ouija board rose in the air several inches, my fingers still attached to it, then crashed to the floor. Apart from the Ouija board, my mother continued to find advice in other, less traditional places. One time she looked under the kitchen sink. That's where she stored a can of old Dutch cleanser. And she picked this up and stared at it as if it held the lucidity of a crystal ball. Holland, she announced. Holland is clean. We are moving to Holland. A few months later, my mother sold our duplex, the furniture, and the car, and then she, my younger brother John, and I boarded the SS Rotterdam and sailed to Holland. Once in Holland, we were unsuccessful in finding housing other than as boarders in a woman's house in Werkhoven. Our landlady, however, did not allow us to keep our lights on beyond 9 o'clock, so how could we finish our homework? Nor did her housekeeping skills satisfy my mother's notions of old Dutch cleanliness. 2 weeks later, we took a train to Germany and landed in Karlsruhe, and 2 weeks after that, still homeless, she bought a car and a handbook of English-speaking schools, which is how we wound up in Montreux, Switzerland, by the shores of Lake Geneva and with the French Alps as the scenery we stared at each day from the mullioned windows that lined the entire length of the front room that served as living room, dining room, and my brother's bedroom. In this resort town, my mother had quickly found our new home, a fully furnished chalet, complete with cuckoo clock and feather-tipped mattresses, renting for $100 US a month. There was also an international school down the cobblestone steps within eyesight of Chateau Chillon, where Lord Byron had chained himself, and this school was attended by the sons and daughters of ambassadors and the founders of great companies. By happy chance, there were two openings for day students, a year's tuition, including skiing for physical education, private piano and art lessons, all at the extravagant cost of $600 a year. In addition, there were young British teachers only a few years older than the junior and senior students. These male teachers became the object of adolescent crushes, and many of the girls made blatant attempts to seduce them. The teachers were cool, however, and let us smoke cigarettes in class and use four-letter words. They would calmly tell the overheated girls to wear something under their fox fur coats that was less revealing than a pair of panties. Meanwhile, an Italian janitor would corner young girls in the basement and attempt to disrobe them. Montreux was also the town where one of the greatest writers of the English language lived, Vladimir Nabokov, whose work would later mean a great deal to me. To this day, I fantasize that we must have met at some point, that perhaps we shared the same funiculaire to Les Avants, where he went to study butterflies, and I went to hang out in cafes and smoke cigarettes with my new European friends. At the actual time of my misbegotten youth, however, I had no great interest in meeting the great writer. I knew only that Nabokov had written Lolita, and therefore was more likely a dirty old man. Meanwhile, I was seeing my own version of an older man, as Cliff Notes once described it. Franz was my first real boyfriend, every mother's nightmare, a 22-year-old frizzy-haired hippie whose father had been a Nazi officer. Franz had wonderful credentials as a romantic. He had deserted the German army. He was a revolutionary whose hero was Che Guevara. He smoked Gauloise cigarettes incessantly to the point of yellowing his fingers. He listened to the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. Believe me, to a 16-year-old girl in 1969, nothing could be more romantic than this combination of attributes. Later, I found out that my boyfriend had escaped from the German army, all right, but it was from its mental hospital. Mental illness, I reasoned, was also romantic in its way. Our romance was fraught with trouble and trauma, mostly because of my mother's interference. She grilled me every day, shouted that I had to give him up, locked me up in the room we shared, and slapped me repeatedly when I asserted I would not. Once tired of my mother's tirades, I tried to break up with Franz. I remember that it was the night before my final examinations in math and chemistry. Up to that point, I had been a straight-A student. That night, Franz threw himself on the train tracks and vowed he would let the next train from Lausanne squish him to pieces if I did not immediately change my mind, hop aboard the next train to Austria, and elope. We argued for over an hour. Then came the warning call of the train. Which would it be, marry him or bury him? We both hurried to the train station. In those intervening minutes, waiting for the train to arrive, I had a chance to ask myself whether I really wanted to be married to a man whose sole occupation was playing foosball in cafes and bumming cigarettes. At the train station, I called my mother from a payphone to let her know what I was up to. Good old mom. Before the train took off, bearing me away to a fate of certain marital unhappiness, the Swiss police arrived. Thus, I did not get married, but due to sheer mental exhaustion from a sleepless night, I did flunk my final examinations the next day. Following this escapade, my mother decided enough was enough. She hired a private detective, turned in my diaries written in Spanish, and had them translated into French. The evidence she managed to gather on me, Franz, and my friends led to the biggest drug bust in Montreux's history. This is not to say it was that big. Only a small stash of psychedelic mushrooms were found in a Volkswagen van, while the biggest part of the illegal goods, 4 kilos of Moroccan hash, had already been tossed into Lake Geneva, where, I was told, it was joyfully devoured by the lakeside geese. My friends were jailed, then deported. Because of my age, I had to appear before a magistrate and promise I would never do anything bad ever again in my entire life. That year, I graduated in my junior year from high school, returned to the U.S., and started my first year in college as an American Baptist scholar chosen for my high morals. That was my childhood. Told as is, it would not make for good fiction. It is too full of coincidences, too full of melodrama, veering on the implausible in both tragedy and comedy. On the other hand, my life, I believe, is excellent fodder for fiction. Memory feeds imagination, and my imagination is glutted with a thanksgiving of nightmares.
This from The Opposite of Fate, her book that will be coming out this fall.
Otherwise known as Every Mother's Nightmare.
Yeah. That might sell better. Yeah. I don't know. Amy, Sandy, maybe we can address that.
We'll address that.
As an agent. Here's the Amy Tan lore that I read about before I met you tonight. Your first book, Joy Luck Club, started as a short story which was published in 17 magazine, which somehow found its way to you, Sandra. You asked for more stories, and then poof, a book, a movie, more books, and then the pinnacle of your career, our Writers' Symposium. And I'm just thinking, wow. All right, now how much of that is true?
Well, the last part is true. I'm here.
Granted.
The first part actually is even more humble than that. It was a story that appeared in a very small literary magazine called FM5 that's now defunct. And it had a circulation of 300. And then it was reprinted in 17. Sandy saw it in 17, but it also heard from somebody, Molly Giles, who today is my editor, that she thought it was a story that Sandy might be interested in taking a look at. So that part is true.
All right. Now, Sandy, what does that mean, somebody wants you to take a look at a story?
Well, you know, you're going to hear two sides. I mean, we're going to compliment each other. But what I recall is that Molly Giles had just won the Flannery O'Connor Award. And I was going up to San Francisco. I was a baby agent. And I wrote her a letter saying, I wonder if you're represented because, you know, I love your stories. And she wrote back.
Well, in this case, wasn't it just story?
No,
Molly
I'm talking
Giles.
About Molly
oh, okay.
Giles. Yeah. She was a wonderful story writer and novelist. And Molly said, well, I'm represented, but I think you should meet a writer I'm working with, Amy Tan. And I remember, Amy, that I seem to remember, I'm trying to remember at which point, I know that your stationery said Amy Tan, business writer.
It just said writer, actually.
It said writer?
It said writer.
But you sent me your resume.
It was all as a business writer.
And your resume was all business writing. And so I think we had a phone conversation before we met. And I said, well, you could write some business books or you could collaborate on some business books. And you said, no, that's what I do for a living. For my pleasure, I want to write fiction. I said, well, then show me, because I hadn't really read anything yet. And you sent me 3 stories.
Okay.
That's what I remember. And that when I read those stories, I said, oh, these are really good. Let's have a meeting. And we set up a meeting at the Claremont Hotel. And I said to Amy, would you please give me an idea of how these stories would connect, you know, or how this might become a collection of stories? And so Amy came armed with an outline. And
boy, your memory of this is really different.
Is that right?
Well, let's see. One handles the marketing side of things. Let's see. Who would that?
No, I mean, it is sort of like that, except that I remember we sort of agreed to work together. And at first, I was just saying, well, I won't have anything for you to sell for probably 10 years. And I'm a business writer, but I don't need an agent for that because
right.
I was
right.
quite overwhelmed with business writing. And it was later when you said, well, I'll be your agent and I'll give you encouragement. Mm-hmm. And so I said, oh, that's fine. You said, you be patient, you'll give me encouragement. Well, every week, like a Jewish mother, Sandy called me up and said, have you written another story? And then I had 3 stories.
That's possible.
And when I had 3 stories, she said, why don't you write an outline of what a whole book of these might look like?
That's right. Okay.
So when I had a couple of hours free, I sat down one afternoon and I just sort of off the top of my head wrote down all these ideas for stories.
Right.
And I sent it to her and just thought she would just look at it. It was not a formalized thing at all. I spent 2 hours writing this outline. And she, unbeknownst to me, or maybe I wasn't paying attention, went to New York while I was in China for the first time. And when I came back from China, she called and said, oh, thank God you're back. I have, I don't know, 3 offers. And I said, what are you talking about? She says, I have 3 offers for your book. And I said, what book? And she said, Joy Luck Club. And I said, Sandy, where are you? What have you done? And I thought, I didn't know this woman. She was a new agent, and I thought, did she take something from the Dream of the Red Chamber and just hand it to somebody and say, this is what my client wrote? Or, you know, because I couldn't believe that publishers would actually make an offer on something that hadn't been written yet. But, you know, this is the amazing talent of Sandy Dykstra, to get people to believe in the vision, you know.
Well, I had a lot of talent here. And Amy, the one thing I want to add to this is that, Amy, I think you said to me once that you organized this around the I Ching, remember? And the title was Wind and Water. And I said, well, coming from California, I will be laughed out of Manhattan if I come in with a book called Wind and Water. I mean, that's what they think we are, basically. And so Amy had this synopsis, because I had said to her, what would hold these stories together? And she had this synopsis, and in the synopsis were these four magical words, the Joy Luck Club. And I got goose pimples when I saw those words. That's my goose pimple test. And I said, could we use that as a title? And Amy said, that's just the club my parents have. You know, they meet on Thursday nights, they play mahjong.
It's like
mahjong.
The Girl Scouts of America. I mean, it just sounded so
it's
prosaic.
It's a stock planning club, yeah. You know? And I said, well, you know, for me, and over the years, the way I describe this is I do believe that titles have to be, authors often say they're not important, you know? They're really not. We can change them later. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. But the truth is that a title is the gateway to an author's imagination. It's the first thing the publisher knows about you, and it's the thing that the editor running through the hall says, I have this project by an unknown author called, and the Joy Luck, I mean, who doesn't want Joy Luck, and who doesn't want to be a member of that club? By the way, there's now a restaurant in New York, which is a derivative, called the Soy Luck Club. Which Amy and I have to try.
Yes.
We have to have a little party at the okay. Soy Luck Club.
Well, I'm glad we got this cleared up because, Sandy, I just had this vision of you sitting down somewhere in your home and reading 17 magazine, like I'm sure you do all the time, seeing this story and say, I've got to have this person
in my stable. No,
okay.
No.
Right.
And in fact, my assistant at that time who read it, actually, I don't think I ever told Amy, she didn't actually like it. But she said, I think you should see this. And when I read it, I said, wow, this is really good. I do have one story that I have to tell about Amy before I forget this moment here. And this is something I always advise, especially fiction authors, and this is something that Amy did without any advice. She just did this. All authors are sent, we'll get into this later probably, an author questionnaire, PR kind of thing to prepare the publisher how to promote you and the book. Well, Amy went and wrote a little story about how she came to be a writer. Do you remember this? Mm-hmm. And she wrote this little story that they then put into the PR kit. And basically what it said was that she was exhausted, stressed out as a business writer, and she went to her shrink to ask help. And she was pouring out her heart to the shrink, and she looked over there, and he had fallen asleep.
That's a sad day. That is a sad, sad story.
And at that point, Amy decided that she had to save her own life and that the way to do that was to write fiction.
What, yeah. Technical writing wasn't getting it for you?
I love my clients. My clients were very nice to me. And but, you know, my heart just never from birth was set out to be that much about telecommunications or account management, things like that. And those were my specialties. I had fallen into this area because I worked with AT&T before divestiture, and when they all broke up into the regional Bell operating companies, you know, I suddenly had 12 more clients, and I just became this telecommunications expert and was hired for this. And I thought, how did my life get steered in this direction? You know, I think we all have this happen where you picture your life being the same way that it is at that moment for the rest of your
life.
And it always, you always pick this when you're in some miserable funk, you know, and thinking this is, you know, I'm going to be changing diapers the rest of my life, or I'm going to be writing this for the rest of my life. And that's what I had. And I decided I needed to do something for me. And I was working 90 hours a week at the time, and I decided I should cut back to about 50, and then I'd use the remaining 40 to write fiction.
I didn't know there were 90 hours in the week.
They were billable hours.
Billable
and
hours.
And I knew that there were 90 billable hours a week because I billed 90 billable. That's how much I was working. I was crazed. I could not stop working. And I needed to find a method that would work to get me to stop. And I would only allow myself to work 50 billable hours, and then I'd have to spend the rest of the time writing something that would not make me any money whatsoever. It would just have to do with writing for myself.
Well, has that translated into your fiction writing, that sort of compulsive writing nonstop kind of thing, even though they're not billable hours? Has that gone from this to that?
In the beginning, it certainly did, because people like you didn't ask me to come to this esteemed place, to come and talk to you all. And so I
hear that all the time.
I know. I would be home. I would be home instead of, here. I would be home by myself in my study writing. And I did. I wrote every day, basically from about 8 in the morning till 7 in the evening when my husband came back from work. And it was a wonderful time of solitude. And then things changed after the publication. And they really haven't been the same since then. But I love those moments when I have nothing to do but write. My time is a lot more fractured now.
Okay. I want to read a quote from an interview that you gave a few years ago, where you said that as you look back on the issues of your life, many of them which you articulated in this reading that you just did, you have deaths of close family members, you're the only Chinese girl in your school, you moved a lot. You said that these are things that make you either psychotic or a fiction writer. Is that what writing does, stave off psychosis?
Well, perhaps I was exaggerating a little. I think that the what I went through was something that caused me to ask a lot of questions in life, and what I was trying to write about in that piece there was this dichotomy that I had between faith that my father had and faith that my mother had, and my trying to find something that worked for me. And so as a writer, I think that I got my origins from that period of mass confusion when so many terrible things happened, and I needed to know what the right questions were, first of all, to ask, before I could come up with the answers. And that's what I mean. I think it also happens to people who become troubled, whether they become mentally ill or psychotic, that I think that you begin to get overwhelmed by the questions or the circumstances in your life, and you don't know how to deal with them either internally or externally with whatever resources you have. Fiction is certainly a way of meditating on those, of coming up with the questions, and also coming up with one set of answers via the form of a story. And when you have to create a narrative, you automatically have to determine how things happen in life, how things work. You are the god of that story in determining how this universe was created, how these troubles came to be, and how they are solved, and what the characters are about. Whether it's within their own sense of themselves that they solve these problems, or whether it is God or fate or a curse that is operational, you get to decide. And so it's a wonderful way to meditate on these questions. It will not necessarily make you less mentally ill or less psychotic necessarily, but, hey, if you sell a book, doesn't matter if you're psychotic, people watch you on talk shows. And you've got it
made. And invite you to symposiums.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. So we really don't know what you are, do we?
Yeah.
Well, okay, but you still have probably the same questions now that you had when you were trying to sort out faith and fate.
I do. And I think that I'll always have them. They're that basic question that I had when I was 6 years old. And the question, how do things happen? Why do they happen? How do I make things happen? What is my role in the universe? Not as, Amy Tan author, but how do I impact, as any individual impacts, the rest of the world, the person around them, the community they live in, the families that they were born into? So I'm constantly asking these questions, and I think, you know, as a fiction writer, my belief is, or what I'm most keen about, are the specifics of those answers, not generalizations or absolute truths, but the specifics and idiosyncrasies that you find in particular stories.
Well, which goes to something else you had talked about in another context about eternal truth versus factual truth. I think you have talked about transcending maybe just these factual mm-hmm. nonfiction things. But you're in a departure with this new book, aren't you, of going back into the nonfiction?
I have not really written nonfiction, and I think I've been afraid to, because my life is, as I indicated, it's a Thanksgiving of nightmares, and I have drawn upon that for my fiction.
Wait a second, did you say a Thanksgiving of nightmares?
I am so grateful that I had such a horrific childhood, because I have so much material now to draw from. You know, but if I were to put it down as it really happened, then it's like saying, here's my source, here's my material. And I can't really change it, you know, it is my life. So I have to put it down. I realize, though, that I can talk about my life as I have in this book, The Opposite of Fate, that I come from it from different angles, and I may end up in another part of my musing talk about that same time in my life when I lost my father and brother and my mother went a little crazy. But I see it differently and I write about it differently. So yes, I can write about the same thing over and over again as nonfiction, as these musings or essays or, you know, reflections. And it's wonderful. It's quite different from the fiction. But I'm enjoying it very much.
Sandy, do you see your job in a relationship with someone like Amy as trying to help bring out something in this writer that the writer might not even see? You know, are you a developer? What's your role here?
Well, I think that, you know, every relationship is different, and Amy doesn't need anybody to do that. You know, she is such a questioner of herself, and she probes and asks questions. So I remember that when the full manuscript for the Joy Luck Club came to me, Amy had spent the whole year writing it after I'd sold it, and almost nothing changed. All those stories were there except, I think, one. And I remember on a Sunday I sat down and I just spent the whole day reading it. And when I finished, I called her. I think you were 35. Were you 35 or 30? And I said, how do you know so much? Remember? I said that to you. I mean, because it was like a book of wisdom about life. And so, no, Amy doesn't. There are authors who need to be asked questions, but Amy doesn't need to be asked questions.
Okay, because
she pushes. She pushes. Yeah, she does. You know, I'm not that wise. She pushes this latest book, The Opposite of Fate. She said she had asked over a number of years. You have so many of these pieces that you've done. You know, would you ever think about putting them into a book? And I just said no. You know, but then the time was right, and you said, what do you think? You know, mm-hmm. this book. And I said, well, I would only want to do something where it really had a shape to it. And I finally felt that I had enough pieces that I had, and I could see the shape. You know, they talk about writers finding their oeuvre later. After you've written a certain number of books, you begin to see the shape of your work. And I could finally do that. And so then I thought, yes, I am ready to do this. And it is cohesive. It's not just a bunch of disparate pieces, you know, it's there. But Sandy really had to give me the old kick in the wazoo there.
Well, you're one of the few writers who I've seen, and on your acknowledgments page of each of your books, you thank your agent, Sandra Dykstra. And in fact, in Joy Luck Club, you said, thank you, Sandy, for saving my life. Were you speaking of the technical writing 90 hours a week life, or were we...
You know, you only have one life to live, and if you devote it to something that you're not passionate about, that becomes your life. And so she gave me a life I could be passionate about. and it was saving my life. I could have gone off in another direction and continued fairly content in on one level with that life, but this was such a different life that, what a dream. It's everybody's dream to do something that you're absolutely passionate about and that you can just sit in a chair all day in your bathrobe, you know, and be passionate about it. You know, there are a lot of bonuses to go with it.
Oh, the things we could talk about now.
Yeah. But, you know.
Sandy, you obviously saw something bigger than just a person's stories from the past. Something bigger was going on as you saw these stories about that Amy was writing that you thought would work with that would connect with audiences.
Well, you know, it's interesting because now that Amy's working on The Opposite of Fate, and when that began, going back and reading all these pieces she had written over a number of years, you know, I'd always known that, au fond, you know, at her heart, Amy was something of a philosopher. And these pieces, the essays, helped me to connect, really, your father and the whole faith background, you know. Because Amy's a very generous writer. I'm not yet answering your question. I mean, she always, as many of you know, there are writers who will just stop and give you the story or give you the character, but Amy always goes beyond that and gives you the story behind the story and the story behind the story, and you get something that is very, very powerful. And I think that when I started with Amy, I loved those three stories, and yeah, I had faith in Amy. And
but you must have seen some universals in
well,
those stories.
Well, I saw it as a sort of coming out of the Joy Luck Club, a kind of, I'm trying to remember actually what the pitch was. It will come to me in a minute, but it's been a while. But it will come to me. But anyway, that I guess that I just really did believe in it. And, you know, those of you who are wanting to find agents and work with agents, I mean, the main thing is, of course, it all starts with your belief in yourself. But then you need somebody else who believes in you and who has the conviction of the worth of your work. And Amy knows that when she came home from China and I got her on the phone, I had just turned down Knopf.
Yeah, my eyes at the other end of the phone.
I had just,
like, she just turned down Knopf.
Knopf.
I mean,
and
that was...
Amy said, what? But...
Knopf is, you know, for those who don't follow what all the imprints are for the in the publishing world, Knopf is one of the more literary houses, and every literary writer would hope to be with a publishing house like Knopf.
So, exactly.
You know,
but
be
I
told
was...
that she had turned down Knopf, or, you know, it's like saying, well, I turned down The New Yorker, you
yes,
know.
Yes, right.
I turned down Knopf. And you're like, what? Are you crazy?
So what had happened was that they had made an offer, which to me translated that Amy would be the lowest little author on their big list. And so I said to Amy, if you'll trust me, I think I can put together something. I said, how much money do you need to pull the plug on that job? And Amy said, $50,000. If I can have $50,000, I can pull the plug. So that was my number. Mm-hmm. And I believe Knopf was offering 15. And I remember
that was a decent advance.
Yeah, any number of beginning
advance.
Writers yeah. would have taken
for
exactly.
three short stories.
Exactly.
It was yes. And when I told them to bring Vintage into the mix, Vintage added 5,000 to it. Remember?
I don't remember any of the money things.
I said to Amy, "Let me just see what I can do." And I remember for me this was unbelievably strange and exciting because Doubleday had just made a two-book offer for $120,000, the stories and whatever else Amy would write. And I'd never been offered for something that didn't exist. You know, it was
two things that didn't exist.
And so I said, Amy, if you will trust, and Amy, the beautiful thing that Amy said, and this is something that, you know, you have got to do in your life when you're in a relationship, whether it be a business relate, you know, you have to make a judgment whether you can place that trust, and then you have to place that trust because you can't do it all yourself. And Amy empowered me by saying, you make the decision, which scared the hell out of me. I trust you, which is terrifying. And so I turned down the two-book offer for $120,000. And then we had this offer from the most important literary editor at one of the most commercial houses in New York, Putnam. But her offer was $50,000, and the poor author I was then touring New York with kept saying, who is this Amy Tan? Because every office I would show up in, I'd get a phone call for somebody who was asking me about Amy's book. Anyway, Faith Sale, this wonderful literary editor at Putnam, had made this $50,000, but it contained world rights. And I'll never forget the editor's office I was in when I said, you can't have the world. Well, Amy has a very beautiful home in San Francisco now that is partially related to the decision to keep world rights. You know? We said, you cannot have the world. And basically got that $50,000 offer from Putnam, and Vintage, which had offered $5,000 when this book came to auction, because in those days reprint rights were sold much more frequently than they are now. And Amy came down the day of the auction, and we were in my office, which was in my home at the time, and then we went to El Fornaio for dinner because we couldn't stand it any longer. It was taking so long. There were 14 houses bidding. And we got I put the phone call in from Il Fornaio in Del Mar. I said, phone is still a holy phone. It doesn't say your name on it, but I may take that sign and put reserve for Amy Tan on it. And
we can sell
auction
it to you.
Went for, and this is all public information, which is why I can talk about it. Vintage, which had originally offered $5,000 for the paperback rights, offered $1.238 million and got the paperback rights. And her publisher at Putnam called me the next day, the toughest woman in New York, other than I, and Phyllis Grand said, I will sue you if I hear that you're talking to any other publisher about Amy Tan. And then we began negotiations for the next book. But anyway, it was an amazing high wire act, and it all began with conviction and trust.
That's although this was not the first time you had been paid for something. As I recall, when you were 8 years old, you sold an essay.
Yes, I did. My very first essay I wrote called What the Library Means to Me. And I had a, you know...
We study it here.
Yes. Especially that opening line, my name is Amy Tan, I'm 8 years old.
We were riveted.
Yes, from the very beginning. But it's the ending that I realized you have to kind of wring their hearts or wring their wallets.
I'm misting up just thinking about
I know.
About
it
the
said
end of it.
I gave, I missed the library so much I gave 18 cents to citizens of Santa Rosa Public Library. And it was my entire allowance, or my entire life savings at that point. Of course, I knew that it would, you know, kind of cause people's hearts to melt and to think that, you know, this little child had given all her money, and that would cause other people to give money to the library. So they made me the winner, and which was a transistor radio.
You won a transistor radio for this.
I won a transistor radio. And today I'm in a rock and roll band. So you see,
you
it's
go.
All connected.
And why are you writing about the opposite of fate? All right. I want to read a sentence or two from The Bonesetter's Daughter and ask you a question from it. We're talking about a family that makes ink in this setting. And it says, good ink cannot be the quick kind, ready to pour out of a bottle. You can never be an artist if your work comes without effort. That is the problem with modern ink from a bottle. You do not have to think. You simply write what is swimming on the top of your brain. And the top is nothing but pond scum, dead leaves, and mosquito spawn. But when you push an ink stick along an ink stone, you take the first step to cleansing your mind and your heart. You push and you ask yourself, what are my intentions? What is in my heart that matches my mind? Well, I bracketed that and I said, you just described the writing process in general, didn't you? I don't know if that was an intentional thing on your part, but that's, you're describing writing.
It was my intention to write about what it's like for me to sit down and write. I know nothing about ink making except what I've done through research, and so I was writing this scene, but, you know, part of this has to do, as you mentioned, it's not the factual details that matter so much as the emotional truth. And when you get that down, you know, it's believable that the person there is sitting with the ink stick and is thinking very seriously about what she needs to write and why. And the tools of that become all part of it. It becomes transparent, you know. But it starts with the thinking.
But it goes beyond that. According to this, it can't be the first things that come.
It
can't be the thin stuff at the top.
Right. That's also a little bit from my parents, my mother especially. You know, if it's too easy, it's not worth pursuing. It has to be more difficult than that. And I find that to be true with writing, too. People often say, you know, if you have to, you know, dig a little deeper and take the things that you love too much and throw them away. And see what really remains. All the stuff that's fancy, all the stuff that you think is going to show you in your best light, take that away and see what remains. And you strip it down to the bare essentials, the bare truth. I try to do that, and as simple as maybe that's stated there, it is very difficult to do. There is so much pond scum on the top of my mind when I begin to sit down. Part of it has to do with people's expectations. You have to get rid of that. Any writer has to get rid of the, when you're writing for yourself, when you're writing literary fiction, you have to be aware of your absolute purest intentions and not be swayed by what you think people want to hear, unless, of course, you're a political speechwriter, you know, or, so, you know, you cleanse yourself in a way, and I like the idea of the rubbing, you know, because it gives you the time to think about the process and how this is all going to meld the heart, the mind, and flow into the hand and onto the page. And so I you know.
Oh, but Amy, what you're describing is work.
Yeah. It's work for a long time, and then there reaches a point that's magical, and I think this is what every writer wants to feel. You get a sensation that is the most wonderful, overpowering emotion, and everything comes together, and suddenly the writing seems effortless. It's not effortless, but it just comes. You know what it is, and when I reach that point, it's rare. It happens only once or twice during the entire writing of the book, but it makes the entire writing of the book worth it. I have little moments of it, you know, in pages, but the big essence of where I know what I'm writing about and it's all clear and it all comes together happens maybe once in the writing of the book.
And those are moments of validation that says, I'm on it.
It's
or confirmation of some sort.
You know, I don't even know how to explain it. It's simply the writing of the book. When somebody says to me, what is your book about? I have to say, it is about the writing of the book. It's that moment that I reach where I am one with the book and it does come out effortlessly, but only because of all the effort that went in before that moment when I could just write and I know what's going to come out, you know, and it just seems to write itself. That is the high point of writing.
We are in a hall right now that is full of writers and wannabe writers and would-be writers and beginning all the way to experienced. I'm wondering, actually, Sandra, if I could start with you, one of the big questions all writers have is, can I get anything published if I don't have an agent? How do I get an agent if I haven't had anything published? We've got this, you've heard that 1,000 times. And so I'm wondering if you can give some of the people here some advice from where you're coming from.
Well, I think that you're all doing the right thing. You're listening to the words of somebody who has found her way in doing this. You're taking courses from a professional. I always think, however, that it all starts with reading, that nobody can be a good writer who is not a good reader. So the very first thing is to be a reader. But then it's about somehow finding your voice and finding what it is that you do best, you know, what it is, you know. Amy could make a lot of money at being a business writer, but it wasn't who she was. And then it's about finding out what your subject matter is. And there's a wonderful, there's just a marvelous couple of passages here at the end of The Bonesetter's Daughter, which tell you how Amy found her subject matter in some way. The picture of her grandmother is in front of her. Ruth looks at it daily. Through it, she can see from the past clear into the present. Could her grandmother have ever imagined she would have a granddaughter like her? And I'm going to move to another section along with this. As Ruth now stares at the photo, she thinks about her mother as a little girl, about her grandmother as a young woman. These are the women who shaped her life, who are in her bones. They caused her to question the order and disorder of her life, whether the order and disorder of her life were due to fate or luck, self-determination, or the action of others. They taught her to worry. But she also learned that these warnings were passed down, not simply to scare her, but to force her to avoid their footsteps, to hope for something better. They wanted her to get rid of the curses. Ruth remembers this as she writes a story. It is for her grandmother, for herself, for the little girl who became her mother. And, you know, I think Amy found what was in her bones, and that was largely, you know, as she told you earlier, her childhood and her family story. And I think, especially for fiction writers, nonfiction writers have to connect with something from the inside outside, but it's about finding your story. Now, this doesn't exactly answer your question because you asked a crasser question about how you get an agent.
I'm at the crass commercialism stage is where
but
I am.
But you got to have the goods to get an agent, you know? And I think that agents are always looking for talent. And in fact, I have a number of young ones, see all the beautiful young ones over there who are wanting to be agents in my office and looking for talent. And I think what you do is you write articles, we read magazines, we come chasing you. You publish reviews that are absolutely breathtaking and they're dazzling in the writing and says at the bottom, I'm working on a novel or I'm working, and we chase you. I always say that it's best to be in the group whom we are chasing. And that's, you know, that's by taking the first few steps yourself, getting into this little fiction magazine, which made Molly feel that you were a writer. You know, well, I mean, she knew you were a writer before that, but, you know, getting your local bookseller to know who you are, getting into a writing group with people whose work you respect. There are many different steps you can take, but it all starts with finding out who you are, what it is you have to say that the world should care about, because without that, it won't happen.
Well, Amy, let me ask you a similar question. I'm sure you're asked for advice all the time by people just getting started. What do you usually tell them? Call Sandy?
No. I would say similar things, but on the very practical level, I would say go to places like this. Go to conferences, go to symposiums, go to workshops, and look at a magazine called Poets and Writers, and you'll see a listing of all kinds of writers, resources for writers and poets, from conferences through fellowships, through grants, retreats, and stay in the company of writers, serious writers, people, and that'll fuel you and keep you going. The other is if you're serious about making your craft better and you're not sure where your voice is, join a writers group, start one, and read your work aloud, and critique it. Know who your good editors are and who your bad editors are. Not all the people in your writer's group are going to be your ideal readers.
You've done this.
I did. I wrote my first two books in a writer's group. So I found it enormously helpful until I could have my own sense of my editorial voice in my head. And if you can find one voice or two readers who can you can really trust, who's whose opinions on your work, you know, seem pretty much on target with your intentions. That's great. Do that. But gradually, you know, it's nurturing yourself as a writer, really, I think. Improving yourself, and then, of course, making those connections, knowing how it works, whether you get into a little magazine, start getting your stories published in little magazines, don't aim for the New Yorker. Believe me, I know now that I'm there, I see how almost impossible it is to get into the New Yorker if you're a completely unknown writer. You know, they have contracts with people like me, you know, and you know, if I send them stuff, they'll publish it, you know, but they do occasionally, but I would say, you know, your best chances, if you want to get the attention of somebody like this, get published in a little magazine. Your chances are better at getting noticed, and they like to discover you there. So, you know, those are just practical things, but I think the big thing is really find your voice and your real reasons for writing. If it's to get published, you got a long, hard road ahead of you, because everybody wants to get published, and your reasons have to be a lot stronger than that to simply stay at it, stay at the writing.
Sandra Dykstra, Amy Tan, thank you so much for being with us tonight. This has been absolutely delightful.
Oh, thank you.